In light of the Massachusetts state court decision allowing gay marriages, the Organization of American Historians, at its meeting in Boston in March 2004, added a session titled The Peculiar Institution of Marriage. Our guest this week, Estelle Friedman, was asked to provide examples of same-sex union in the past. She later expanded the charge to include alternatives to marriage and to provide historical perspectives on the contemporary social movement for marriage equality. That resulted in an article in the OEH newsletter of August 2004, Boston Marriage, Free Love, and Fictive Kin, Historical Alternatives to Mainstream Marriage. Welcome, Estelle.
Thank you.
What did you hope to accomplish by writing this history of alternatives to traditional marriage?
Well, quite honestly, I wanted to expand the historical repertoire for thinking about long-term committed unions in light of what's going on today. And as you mentioned, when I was asked to find examples of same-sex unions in the past, I felt that wasn't really going far enough, that we really need to think about how unions looked different from all kinds of perspectives, including critics of marriage in the past, not only those who were trying to emulate marriage when they were excluded from it.
Okay. And among the practices you discuss in your article, you include gender crossing, for example, and give some historical examples of this. Tell us about Mrs. Nash.
Mrs. Nash was married several times out in the Western Territories to soldiers in the forts in that area. And it wasn't until her death that they realized Mrs. Nash was, in fact, born male. And we don't know if the men who married Mrs. Nash were intending to be in a same-sex union or whether they were surprised to find this out. But it's an example of people who passed for the other gender in the 19th century, something that was often reported in newspapers, particularly of women passing as men.
You also write about men or women who retained their gender identity, but still established marriage-like relationships long before the current move in that direction.
That's right. It wasn't only when a woman pretended to be a man and then became a husband, but sometimes two women would set up a household together or two men would set up a household together. And in fact, there was a phenomenon that was so frequent in one northeastern city of college-educated women who would form a union, share domicile, share a bedroom, take their vacations. The family knew them as a couple, that it was called a Boston marriage, partly because there were so many college-educated women in the Boston area.
What I found interesting about that is it really didn't create much of a scandal.
Not in the late 19th century, because of the assumption that these women were chaste. That is, if there wasn't a man in the house, they couldn't be having sex. So that they were spinsters, that they were simply good friends. Some of them, I'm sure, were, but some of them could have also had a sexual component to their relationship. Until the early 20th century, they were not necessarily interrogated in terms of whether they were sinning sexually.
And that was the point at which the whole idea of homosexuality caught up with such unions?
In a sense, that's correct. The very concept homosexuality did not emerge until the late 19th century in the sexological literature that was coming out of Europe and then popularized in the United States. And by the early 20th century, you begin to have an identity of homosexuality. Many theories about whether it's biological and whether it's natural or unnatural and whether it's curable or not. But increasingly in the early 20th century, it's a stigmatized identity. And ironically, you might say, as for some women, the so-called sexual revolution acknowledged sexual desire, for women whose sexual desire didn't take the normative direction of heterosexuality, another term that's invented at the time, there was more of a barrier or a boundary, more of a stigma associated with same-sex desire. So women living together in the early 20th century had to be very careful to make sure they had those separate beds or to make sure that people knew they weren't sleeping together in a way that women earlier used to share beds without it necessarily being assumed they might be sexual.
Interesting. Okay, so far we've been talking about practices, but this wasn't just a matter of practice. People actually took time to think this through and write about it. And one of the things you talk about in the 19th century is how this worked into utopian ideas. Tell us how the idea of sexuality and marriage was taken in that context.
Well, here's where we get to the critics. That is, not only do you have some people establishing marriage-like institutions, Boston marriage, or men who might have lived together, you also had some what we would later call heterosexuals, saying marriage itself was something they did not want to partake in. And I'm thinking here of the utopian free lovers, those who felt everyone should be free to have a union without the church or the state sanctioning it. Now, free love did not mean promiscuity. It meant you chose a mate, you lived together like marriage, you have children together, but why should the state or the church have to say who you could be with? And in fact, some of these writers considered marriage a form of prostitution because it gave a husband the right to have sex with a wife, whether she wanted to or not. People like Francis Wright in the early 19th century, Marx Edgeworth Lazarus writing in the 1850s about whether marriage is really a form of prostitution, and some of the free lovers in the late 19th century who went to jail rather than have a marriage ceremony, or who went to jail for writing critically about marriage or what we would today call marital rape, really stood up for their beliefs and paid.
Okay, that's a key point. We want to come back to that later because you have some interesting things to say about where these unions stand now. But let's take you into the 20th century here. And you write that by the early decades of the 20th century, gay and lesbian subcultures formed in the nation's largest cities, expanding the opportunities for same-sex unions. Tell us how that came about.
Well, over the course of the late 19th century, the early 20th century, when we have a more urban society, more wage earners who are able to live apart from family in more anonymous cities, you do begin to find communities forming in New York City, for example, or in probably Chicago, Washington. We have some people who observe there are men who get together in certain parks or certain baths, and you're beginning to have an urban space, an urban geography that's the forerunner of later 20th century lesbian, gay, urban communities and subcultures. Sometimes they're more private than visible, maybe house parties. By the mid-20th century, there's a whole bar culture. We know that in some large cities like New York, there was even some tolerance for some of the cross-dressing practices or some of the fascination in nightclub life with people who were sort of on the margins of bohemian worlds and also might overlap with this emerging homosexual subculture. So very slow to come to smaller towns in the United States, I would say, even today. But by the 1920s, 1930s, you could find gay and lesbian subcultures in quite a number of America's large cities. And of course, when people are in a subculture and beginning to identify as lesbian, gay, homosexual, there may be more opportunities. You go to the bar, you meet somebody, you go to the party, you meet someone, you make eye contact on the street or in the park, and you begin to have more possibilities that they may become relationships. Now, I just want to say that at this time in the early 20th century, the stigma is still so strong, as especially for men, these meetings often have to be so surreptitious that there's a disincentive to acknowledging or to entering into long-term relationships. And that's something that's going to change later in the century.
Let's move up to later in the century, because I think you make, to me, a very interesting historical point here. You start off by saying that the institution of marriage remains, as you put it, a privileged site for heterosexual unions. But then you take up a very interesting subject here, which is that much of what we've been talking about has constituted an attack on the institution of marriage, largely for what was seen as its patriarchal trappings. But now we're seeing a mass movement by same-sex couples not to topple the institution, but to extend it or its privileges to themselves. So have same-sex couples now come to embrace the institution?
Well, some have and some haven't. And the historical point, I think, is that the change in the late 20th century from the stigmatized identity, the underground subcultures, to gay liberation, embracing a gay or lesbian identity openly, beginning to have laws passed, more tolerance, in a sense, made it more easy or at least encouraged long-term couple formation. Once you begin to get long-term couple formation, yes, I think a number of people, in fact, mass numbers, clearly seek the privileges of marriage. Now, we talked about those free lovers who had criticized marriage in the 19th century. Well, early gay liberationists, say, in the late 1960s, the early 1970s, also considered marriage a patriarchal institution. But by the 1980s and by the 1990s, you don't hear that radical critique so much, the smash monogamy and smash marriage. You actually have thousands and thousands of couples settling down, having a mortgage, having a long-term relationship, and thinking of themselves like married couples, but without the benefits that married couples had. So you have, on the one hand, this proliferation of same-sex partnerships. At the same time, and I think this is also important to the story, marriage has changed. Marriage is less patriarchal than it once was. Certainly in the 18th or 19th century, when a husband really could rule over the wife and the children, the servants, and in some areas, the slaves. Increasingly, you have a more companionate or egalitarian model for marriage. You no longer have the husband's rule over the wife. So marriage looks different, and more same-sex couples look like married couples.
You indicate that there's at least three measures that you put forward that illustrate this changing meaning of marriage. Let's talk about maybe each one of them briefly. Reproduction, okay, no longer being a primary function through the life of marriage.
Sure. In 1800 or 1900, marriage looks different than it does in the year 2000. In 1800, the average married woman during her reproductive years bore 8 children. She died pretty young, too. Most of her married life was spent bearing and rearing children. 1900, average 4 children, 2000, average 2 children, and some people choose not to have children. So there's no longer this strong correlation between being married and constantly bearing children.
Woman working?
Well, increasingly in the 20th century, more and more women, married women, and mothers of children are wage earners. This gives them some leverage in terms of leaving unhappy or abusive relationships, or even entering marriage later. Entering marriage by choice, not necessity. So marriage is not just purely reproductive, it is more by choice.
And the fact that the state is expanding benefits to those in legal unions?
Well, yes, the state has become more important over the course of the 20th century in constructing much of our lives. So tax law, for example, or immigration policy depend upon your marital status, your filing status for taxes, or inheritance for children, or whether a partner who you marry can come into this country as an immigrant. True for married couples, not true for same-sex unions.
How important has the AIDS crisis been in all of this?
I think that's a really good point, because when I gave that sort of sweeping background of gay liberation and this sort of shift towards stable unions, we really didn't talk about this major historical event of AIDS in the 1980s. And I think for a couple of reasons. For one, so many people coming out during that crisis by necessity, but also others because it had become a public issue. And also so many partners of those with AIDS who were denied visitation rights or who lost what had been common property because they were not legally protected. All of that brought up issues of partner rights. And I think it also made more poignant the issues, oh, take a movie like Philadelphia, where people began to realize there are long-term committed couples who are suffering from certain legal disabilities. And actually, there's one other thing that we should talk about. I may be anticipating here your own questions, but it's not only the AIDS crisis, but something else was happening in the 80s and 90s that's sometimes called the gay boom, that is the gay baby boom. And more lesbians and to some extent gay men were choosing to become parents within these committed relationships. So it's not only the tragedy of AIDS, but also bringing new life, raising children, sometimes adopting, sometimes through artificial insemination or multiple parenting arrangements. And in the same way that AIDS highlighted the needs for rights for couples, so has gay parenting, second parent adoptions, for example, and all kinds of issues of inheritance. So the legal rights become necessitated by these social changes.
Okay, you did anticipate, and that's great. And I think we're going to have to leave it there.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Estelle Friedman, Edgar E. Robinson Professor in U.S. History at Stanford University. Professor Friedman is the author of Boston Marriage, Free Love and Fictive Kin, Historical Alternatives to Mainstream Marriage, which appeared in the August 2004 issue of the Organization of American Historians newsletter. She's also the author of No Turning Back, The History of Feminism and the Future of Woman, published by Ballantine Books. This is Talking History.